Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KABU program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Renee Denfeld, author of the new novel, The Butterfly Girl, from HarperCollins. The Butterfly Girl is Renee's second novel, featuring private investigator Naomi Cottle, a.k.a. The Child Finder. The first book is aptly titled The Child Finder, and Renee also authored the novel The Enchanted, which earned the prestigious French Prix Award, an ALA Medal for Excellence in Fiction, a Carnegie listing, and a listing for the Dublin International Award. She's also published in The Washington Post, The New York Times, and The Philadelphia Inquirer. In addition to her fiction and journalism, Renee is a licensed private investigator. In 2017, her advocacy for victims was recognized with a Breaking the Silence Award for her social justice work, and she was named a 2017 Hero of the Year by the New York Times. She lives here in Portland with her three children. In the words of Margaret Atwood, The Butterfly Girl is a heartbreaking, finger-gnawing, and yet ultimately hopeful novel by the amazing Renee Denfeld. Renee Denfeld is truly amazing, and she's here with us now in the KABU studios. Renee, welcome to Between the Covers.
Thank you for having me here. I really appreciate it.
Renee, you didn't write your first novel until you were in your 40s, but before that you wrote three nonfiction books. The Enchanted was your first work of fiction that followed several years later. Why'd you go from nonfiction to fiction? I know you've said previously, and this is a quote, "I think fiction can tell a much deeper truth. In fiction, we can truly immerse ourselves in the lives of others."
Absolutely. You know, I know many very gifted nonfiction writers. For me, I started writing nonfiction books in my early 20s. And actually, looking back, I've joked before that somebody should have passed a law against me writing books in my early 20s. You know, I was very hot-headed. Like a lot of young people, I thought I knew everything. And you know, as a result, to be really honest, I'm not proud of my early nonfiction books. They just lacked the compassion, they lacked the nuance, they lacked the understanding that I developed, you know, as we often develop as we get older. And so what ended up happening is I had been also working as an investigative reporter and a journalist. And then in the early 2000s, the bottom fell out of that industry.
And hasn't returned, really.
It never has. You know, all my friends at the Oregonian started getting laid off. It became increasingly hard to sell nonfiction books or reporting articles. So I ended up going into the criminal justice work at that time and got a job at the public defender's office. And that actually, interestingly enough, ended up inspiring my first novel, which wasn't what I had intended to happen. It wasn't what I was expecting to happen, but that's what
happened. Were you thinking of writing novels like before those the private investigator job with the public defender?
Yeah, you know, I always wanted to write fiction. When I was young, I would write poetry, and I actually spent some time living on the streets of Portland when I was a girl. And when I got off the streets, one of the first things I did was I got this battered, used typewriter from a thrift store. And if I remember right, I think it was missing like the R key. And I would have to go write in the letter.
Write in the letter on.
Write in the letter on all the things. And I would write these poems. I'm sure the poems were probably not very good at all. But I would write these poems and staple them together and leave them around bus stops for other homeless kids like myself. And so I always felt this real passion for writing poetry, for writing short stories, for writing fiction, and I felt a longing for it. But I honestly think it took me a long time to really develop the wisdom to do it, the sense of
wisdom. So it wasn't just the craft, it was the wisdom to write the fiction. You see that in younger writers, you know, they've got the craft down. They can write beautiful sentences, but a lot of that life experience isn't really there yet.
Yeah, exactly. And I think if you're writing fiction, you have to be really ready to tell the truth. the complex, often difficult, sometimes really joyous truth. And fiction is telling the truth of people. It's telling people's stories. So I think it really helps to have the life experience of being able to tell the truth of people's stories.
And your own story.
My own story.
Which is reflected in your books, too, and we'll get to that. I have a quote. When you started writing fiction, you said, "Everything I learned, all the humility, the compassion that was gifted to me by the work, my joy in the poetry of life came rushing out," which sounds like a joyful transition, but was it an easy one from writing nonfiction? What were the challenges?
It was an absolutely joyous moment. I'll never forget, I had actually been working death row cases for several years.
And that was your first novel.
And that inspired my first novel. And I hadn't written for quite some time. I was raising my family and working at the Public Defender's Office, which I just have to give a shout out to my friends at the Public Defender's Office here in Portland. They're just amazing advocates and warriors for justice. And I'd been doing that and just really absorbed in trying to help people. And I was actually leaving the death row prison one day, and I'll never forget, it was this beautiful spring day. And the death row prison here in Oregon is this very kind of foul, fetid old dungeon.
Where's it located?
It's outside of Salem.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was built in 1846.
Wow.
And so I was leaving. I remember I had my car keys in my hand, and this feeling when you leave a prison of just kind of the air kind of feels like it's rising off of you, because when you're inside, there's just so much sadness. And I was walking through the parking lot, and the first sentence of my first novel just came to me.
And it came to you in a very interesting way, right?
Yeah,
you had written that you felt there was a gentleman sitting next to you with his scaly feet up on the dashboard. He had gray hair. Mm-hmm. I mean, you actually described him. You saw him, right?
Yeah,
as an image.
He felt as real to me as anybody else. It felt like he was an inmate in this prison that I just hadn't met yet. And so he began telling me this story, and I rushed home and I started writing. And when I started writing fiction, it felt like all of my life experience, everything that I had gone through, everything I had learned, sometimes through, really difficult circumstances, it just came rushing out. And it did. It felt absolutely redemptive and transcendent.
I want to talk about, before we get specifically into the books, certainly The Butterfly Girl, there have been several studies showing that reading books, specifically fiction, literary fiction, makes us more empathetic, not just to the characters in the books, but to the other people in our lives. There's a Canadian cognitive psychologist named Keith Oatley, and he said fiction is a kind of simulation, one that runs not on computers, but on minds, a simulation of selves and their interactions with others in the social world based in experience and involving being able to think of possible futures. Literary fiction, in other words, works like a flight simulator, only it trains you to avoid crashing and burning as a human rather than as a pilot. Has fiction worked that way for you, allowing for you to think of possible futures, especially given your kind of very difficult childhood?
Absolutely. Yeah. If you think about it, we're finding out more and more about the brain, and the brain is actually this incredibly plastic, growing mechanism.
You're very adaptable.
It's very adaptable. You look at how, for instance, occupational therapy with stroke victims and people who lose part of their brains through some form of damage can sometimes strengthen other parts of their brains. So the brain is always growing and these connections are being made. And I think when we're reading fiction, as well when we're writing fiction, we are literally kind of retraining or remaking our own brain. And for me, it's been huge in healing from my own trauma, because I'm telling the stories. A lot of the stories of my books are very informed by my own history and my own life.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Both Naomi and Celia, characters in The Butterfly Girl, have autobiographical elements from your life.
Absolutely. But here's the beautiful thing is the ending's different. So in fiction, we can tell these sometimes really terrible and very difficult truths. But we can also really, I think, gather together the wisdom we have of like, how can we prevent these things? How can we change these things? How can we help each other heal? how can we make the ending different? And I think that's one of the really wonderful things about fiction is fiction can kind of be a roadmap to a better future.
It's also, in terms of the empathy, it allows us to get into characters' heads and see the world from their perspective. I know I felt that way just about 20 pages into mm-hmm. The Butterfly Girl. I just felt more compassionate to the homeless in Portland. And of course, there's homeless in a lot of big cities, and we tend to ignore them out of fear or out of guilt for whatever reasons. Is sparking that compassion for the less fortunate something you're consciously aware of when you're writing your novels?
Yes and no. I think part of it is I write my novels about people that I know or would know in real life. And I come from poverty and abuse myself. I had a very difficult upbringing, but I also had an upbringing that was filled with a lot of joy and love and warmth. You know, these things, you know, are often very complicated. These are the kind of people that I grew up around. These are the experiences that I had. It would be really hard for me to write a book that was, for instance, set on an Ivy League school campus. Those would be characters that I, you know, don't really have a lot of firsthand experience with. So it is a matter of writing who I know and what I know. And the compassion happens to me naturally because I feel a lot of compassion for all of us. I mean, so many of us right now are struggling. This is just a very difficult time for our country.
It's an extremely stressful time. I have friends who can't sleep. And I wake up every day wondering, is this some science fiction world that we're living in? How could this be? Won't get too, too much into the details.
It's an absolutely terrifying time. And our country is traumatizing us. We're being traumatized. So these, you know, and the trauma is not just confined to the homeless. I think it's something that's just true of all of us right now. And so I feel like I have this wonderful opportunity of not just showing the trauma, but again, kind of giving that map. It's the path through the woods. How do we get out of here? How do we find our way home? That's really, you know, what engages me.
Before we get more into the new novel, I want to go back a bit about mm-hmm. 25 years, and this involved a book that you may not be as proud of, though. That's Kill the Body, the Head Will Fall. I read that you were an amateur boxer, and a very good one. Mm-hmm. You were the first woman to win the Tacoma Golden Gloves Tournament, and that was in 1995. And there is a boxing in the book. Naomi, the protagonist of both The Child Finder, The Butterfly Girl, she's also an amateur boxer. And without giving too much away, I can say that title, Kill the Body, the Head Will Fall, comes in very handy for Naomi in this particular book. What was your interest in taking up boxing? Was it recreation, self-defense, and what did it teach you?
Yeah, you know, Kill the Body was my second nonfiction book, written again in my 20s. Can I take it all back? But actually, it's a book that was largely inspired by my experiences as being one of the first female boxers. And I got into the sport actually because I had been living on the streets. I had experienced a great deal of trauma. I was afraid. And I'm not a very big person. And so I grew up being very afraid. And often for good reason. And boxing, at that time, women just didn't do it. I was the only female in the gym that I went to.
Was that a gym here in Portland?
Yeah, it was. I was at the Grand Avenue Boxing Gym, which is actually right around the corner from here at KBOO.
Wow. So it's on Grand Avenue.
It used to be. Yeah, they kind of got pushed out by the gentrification. But it was a stinky, smelly old boxing gym, old-fashioned boxing gym, you know, the kind with buckets of blood in the corner. You know, they weren't big on hygiene there. And I was not only the only woman, I was actually the only white person on my team, which was the Sandovals. And my coach, Jesse, was an old Mexican fighter, you know, the kind with cauliflowered ears and a flat, no nose, just, you know. And he actually turned into a surrogate father figure for me. And learning how to box was just huge for me because I learned how to fight back. It was just such a massive change for how I looked at myself in the world. I stopped feeling as helpless. I learned to defend myself. And this comes up in my second novel, The Child Finder, but also is touched upon in The Butterfly Girl, because learning to box is also about learning how to grapple with your own fear Jesse used to say, "The fighter that gets mad always loses."
Oh, that's great! So yeah. you need that self control.
You need the self control, and actually, you know, so I learned a lot of really good life lessons about aggression and anger, and how to really kind of confront the demons that I carried as well. So yeah, it was an amazing period in my life.
Now, there was another great Portland writer, Catherine Dunn, the author of Geek Love, among other work. She loved boxing. She wrote about it, and she was an amateur boxer, too. She wrote the foreword for your boxing book. Were you friends with Catherine, and was she an inspiration for your own work and maybe your own life?
Yeah, Catherine, I miss her so much.
Catherine, she was a big friend of KABU. She had a show here, Gremlin Time.
Yeah, Catherine. Oh, wasn't she amazing?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, Catherine and I became close friends. She was kind of a big sister, just like Jesse was a surrogate father. Catherine and I used to go to the gym together every day. I would go pick her up at, she had a house up in Northwest Portland, and we got to know each other through boxing because she came to the gym, and this is a real blast from the past, but she was writing about boxing, and there was, you know, here I was, the first female doing this, and she actually wrote an article about me.
Oh, where was that? Was that in the Oregonian?
No, it was actually, of all things, it was published in Vogue magazine.
Oh, my.
So, you know, I joked then and I joke now, that was my one and only appearance in Vogue magazine, and it was there was a picture of me in the boxing gym, all sweaty, you know, blood-stained shoes and all. She was wonderful. I would pick her up in my old Boattail Riviera 1972, you know, beater car, and she knew that I wanted to be a writer. And Catherine was actually the one that encouraged me and told me that I could do it. Because I felt that somebody from my background, that we couldn't be writers, that you had to come from a certain sort of upper class background.
Right, the John Updikes of the world.
Yes, exactly. That was the image I had.
Right.
I was a voracious reader, but I had this image of who gets to be a writer. Mm-hmm. And Catherine actively discouraged me from that. And she would encourage me to write. She used to also insist that I read all the classics.
Ah, and do you remember some of the reading list there?
Oh, you know, she had me, the Odyssey. She had me read Shakespeare.
Wow.
I remember in between rounds at the boxing gym, her asking me questions about my reading.
So you can't really say you're uneducated when your teacher is Catherine Dunn,
right? That is true. I got my free MFA from Catherine Dunn and the public library.
Now, let's go back to the books now, The Enchanted and The Child Finder, so the fiction. We mentioned that The Enchanted got its start from this encounter with an imaginary old man whose scaly feet up on the dashboard talking to you. The second, The Child Finder, from a little girl who's starting to talk with you while you were walking in a Portland snowstorm, or after a snowstorm, and snow's a rare event here, but that was when you got that idea. I think we were snowed in for about a week. Can you tell us about those voices, and did something similar happen for the butterfly girl? Was there some kind of appearance? Or?
There was. You know, and all my novels have kind of come to me with one of the characters talking to me directly.
Mm. Was it Celia or
it
Naomi?
Was Celia. Oh, it was Celia this time. And interestingly enough, I was out of town and walking down a street. And, you know, I don't think the location played any place in it, but I was in a city. And it was, you know, bringing back a lot of memories about being a street kid myself. And when I was on the streets of Portland, it was the early 1980s. And, you know, I think that was kind of just percolating in the back of my mind. And then I, you know, suddenly kind of heard this little girl, and she was talking about the butterflies.
Ah.
Yeah. And she said, you know, someday I'm going to go to the Butterfly Museum.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's just amazing to me.
Yeah.
And then you turn this event, imaginary voice, into this incredible novel. And that does play a big part in there.
It's a huge, yeah. And it was when this has happened, it's like these characters kind of feel like they just kind of appear fully formed. You know, and, you know, I get to know more about that particular person. But yeah, Celia, as it turned out, is this little 12-year-old street girl who lives on the streets of a city, much like Portland. And she believes that butterflies are going to save her.
And that's really the kind of the premise of the book.
And that is the premise of the book.
Right.
And meanwhile, she knows some things that are very, very important. So yeah, the book, The Butterfly Girl, is very much the story of Celia's life, and it also brings back Naomi from The Child Finder as well.
Now, I read also that The Child Finder, you originally wanted to call The Snow Child, mm-hmm. which was kind of this fairy tale that the character Meredith kind of found very comforting.
Mm-hmm.
She was the snow child. And mm-hmm. Of course, The Butterfly Girl here, you actually got to use the title. The snow child, you couldn't use that because there was another book with that title?
Yeah, there was actually there's a wonderful book called The Snow Child, and it's written by a Canadian writer. And I read it, and for some reason, I'm not remembering her name offhand, uh-huh. but I highly suggest that people pick it up. And it's also like my book, The Child Finder, incorporated aspects of retelling a Russian fairy tale.
Ah.
There's a Russian fairy tale, actually, called The Snow Child or The Snow Princess. And so, but, you know, it's an interesting thing because, you know, there's so many writers out there, and I thought it was really fascinating that this other woman writer from Canada had her own kind of interpretation of retelling this story, and I had mine. And if you read the two books, they're completely different. But as it turned out, you know, I couldn't have the same titles. So.
Yeah, I was going to mm-hmm. get into that a little mm-hmm. later, the importance of fairy tale and myth.
Mm-hmm.
There were two writers I've interviewed recently. One was Todd Davies, who has this fantasy series, Arcadia.
Mm-hmm.
And she's extremely, she emphasizes the importance of fairy tales, not just to children, but adults. And the last one you might know are Karen Russell, who's a Portland-based writer for her book Orange World.
Mm-hmm.
And she really mixes fairy tales with kind of the surreal aspects, the observed, and of course some real-life mm-hmm. settings, including here in Portland and where she grew up in Florida. It seemed some similarities between your work and theirs in that respect, kind of the emphasis you give to fairy tales and their importance beyond just, you know, once upon a time, you know, children's stories.
Oh, absolutely. I think fairy tales and fables are incredibly important. As you think about it, where else can you be trapped in an oven, you know, buried in a dungeon?
Right.
You know, you have the witch who's trying to burn you alive and still, through the power of people's imaginations and through the powers of their own resiliency and inventiveness, they are able to escape. So I think fairy tales are this beautiful kind of template for survival. And when I was a little girl, I spent a lot of time in the public library, and it was fairy tales and fables that I loved so much.
Without giving too much away, it actually plays a big part in the book in solving the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Naomi solves one of the mysteries in The Butterfly Girl, and here's the passage that mm-hmm. I'll read. "It's like the fairy tales," Naomi said, remembering her other missing child cases. "Celia was trapped and lost alone in the wilderness. She will have left a trail of crumbs somewhere. All children do," which I thought that was ingenious of you to kind of bring in this fairy tale element.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it was an important way for her to solve this missing child case.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's true. I think we all leave a trail of crumbs. You know, we're all, you know, kind of out there in some way or another saying, "Hey, find me, help me." You know, and that's the gift that we really can give each other. You know, we all want to be seen and heard. We all want to be found, so to speak. And that is part of our culture that we live in right now, that people, I think, are feeling very unseen and terrified. And, you know, we have this power and gift to be able to give each other.
And part of that is through fairy tales. And I also want to talk about the importance of dreams and imagination mm-hmm. in this book and your other books, too. We talked about how it builds empathy, mm-hmm. reading literary fiction and imagining possible futures for ourselves, even when there's very little hope. And this is from an essay you wrote for The Washington Post in 2017. Mm-hmm. It talks a little bit about your childhood. "Growing up with poverty, molestation, and abuse, I often wished for a new family. I daydreamed about what such a life would be like. There would be hugs in the morning, plates full of food, and a safe bed for sleep. I would not have to worry about my mother's boyfriends, one of them later convicted as a registered predatory sex offender." The importance of imagination, daydream, just seems so possible, so evident in your novels. And I was wondering if you would read us a passage from The Butterfly Girl so the listeners can kind of get a little better idea of that.
Absolutely. Okay. "All the way back downtown, walk, buses, walk, Celia engaged in her favorite pastime, which was to daydream. Dream by day, her teacher, Mrs. Wilkerson, once told her. Dream by night, Your imagination can save you, Celia. Reality is whatever you choose to see, the face of a gnome in the grass, a construction team of elves on an anthill, the way tree leaves lace together to make messages that only you can read. And oh yes, there were the butterflies. They cascaded around her now, tickling her tired feet, lifting her shoes all the way back to the bus stop. They rode next to Celia through the bus window. And as she got off downtown, one grabbed a hold of a strand of her hair. Celia laughed. She could remember being a little girl in a sun-splashed meadow with her mother. She could feel her wings open. "What are you doing, Celia?" "Flying," she told the imaginary person in her mind.
That's so beautiful.
Thank you.
And that comes all from that Celia coming to you before you wrote the book and telling you about the butterflies and the butterfly museum.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think I'm just a strong believer in the power of imagination. I think actually imagination is a radical act.
That's what I want to talk about. Mm-hmm. There's other examples how you emphasize imagination as a survival mechanism. Mm-hmm. The death row inmate in The Enchanted. The missing child and the child finder, she imagines herself as the snow girl we talked about. And Celia, of course, who sees and hears butterflies guiding her. There's also another character with an imaginary friend named Little Self who lives under her armpit and talks to her. Mm-hmm. And I won't go into any more detail there. But in The Butterfly Girl, you write, "The ones who survived captivity were the children who had learned to escape into make-believe worlds." Can you talk about that, kind of the role of imagination in helping your characters survive and maybe how it helped you heal as well? And you were talking about it as a radical act.
It is. You know, as a little girl, that's how I survived. I escaped into this fantastical world of imagination. And there were, you know, months of my life where I don't really remember much of what happened because I was so, you know, what I remember is the imaginary world that I lived inside. And you know, for instance, I had this fantasy that I was going to be rescued from my situation. And I would
Which is a fairy tale fantasy.
It's a fairy tale fantasy. And I would make these secret little hash marks on the wall of my bedroom. And they were the day that I was going to get rescued.
Wow.
And of course, the day would come and it wouldn't happen. But I kept the hope alive. I would just imagine it would happen again. And, you know, I've since worked with death row inmates. And I also am a longtime foster adoptive parent. And so I work and help a lot of people that have also experienced trauma. And I believe that imagination is what we really need to be talking about. We talk about resiliency, but it's actually imagination that is the most radical act. Because if we have an imagination, we can imagine a different future for ourselves. We can imagine ourselves going to school or getting a job or, you know, finding a different set of people to be around. When we have an imagination, it's basically kind of a proclamation that I deserve something different.
And kind of a prerequisite for that alternate life or that possible life.
Exactly. Every time we imagine, we're essentially, I think, proclaiming and reaffirming our own existence. You know, we have the power to create ourselves. And when you have an imagination, that's something no one can take from you. You know, it's something that is, you know, especially just for us. And I think particularly for children, but also for adults, you know, instead of talking about resiliency, I think we should talk about imagination.
Now, The Butterfly Girl has two main protagonists. There's the investigator, Naomi Cottle. She's in her early 30s in the book, and the street kid, Celia, who's 12 years old. And I think it's evident by now that there are traces of your past in both of these characters. How do you integrate those elements into the story? So your childhood is a little bit like Naomi's and Celia's, and there is a predatory parent involved in the book, too, with Celia's stepfather, Teddy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, and as a writer, I think that's a really important thing to think about because, you know, you definitely as a writer, I want to mine my own life. I think, you know, it's really good and it's valuable to take our own experiences and fictionalize them. But at the same time, it's really important to me to create these characters that are not me. You know, what I strive to do is create these whole distinct characters. I think that's why they come to me as completely new people. Because they have to be, it's important. I think we've all had the experience of reading a book where it's too obvious that the writer has just created a brand new version of themselves.
Yes, kind of a perfect version. Yes, a lot of times.
Exactly. You know, you go to the back cover and you see some guy that's like, you know, and then you know, and basically what you have a lot of times, unfortunately, is writers try to create a better version of themselves. And I don't want to do that. What I try to do is use my experiences, and then I create whole new characters. So those characters can be flawed and human, and I don't have any particular axe to grind in making them behave any certain ways. I want them to have their autonomy as characters.
And you're not any one character. As I mentioned, there's mm-hmm. both Celia and Naomi there that has elements of your past.
Yeah. I see them, you know, the way I look at it as a writer is like, I'll often be writing and I think, wow, what a coincidence that this character also has,
and then you kind of figure it out.
Well, yeah, I figured it out. Like, wait a minute. I've been, you know, so... You know, but it's important that the character also kind of lives and breathes outside of me, and they have their own autonomy, and so that I feel free to let them make their own mistakes.
Let's get a little bit autobiographical. In one of in the book, in Butterfly Girl, so Celia, one of her only pleasures is visiting the Central Library in downtown Portland, where she takes refuge among the books, including a book on butterflies, which she just falls in love with and wants to read every time she visits. And there's a librarian there that befriends her. Did you have a similar experience growing up on the streets of Portland?
Yes, I did. And, you know, I wish I could go back and find some of the people that helped me.
Some of those librarians?
Some of those librarians. When I was living on the streets of Portland, the downtown Portland Library was pretty much the only safe place to go. And I went there a lot. And I'd always been a voracious reader. And so I escaped into the world of books inside the sanctuary of this place. And the library is one of the few places that lets homeless people come in. And there was an elderly librarian that worked there, and I don't recall her name. I can see her in my mind. She was tall and thin, and she wore those kind of glasses that have a little necklace thing on them.
Oh, yes. That's almost like the stereotypical librarian.
Yeah, she looked like a stereotypical librarian, and I'm pretty sure she wore a wig because it was always on. It was on a little crooked sometimes. And she was just so sweet and so kind to me. And I have this very vivid memory of one time I was walking back outside and they start flicking the lights on, time for the library to close. And once again, it was pouring rain. And I had already, you know, when you're on the streets, you get wet, you don't dry off. And you walk around all day in soggy shoes and your one pair of socks. And, you know, you feel so terrible. And people just look through you, and nobody even acknowledges that you exist, unless they want something bad. And so I just so often felt filled with shame, and I felt so lost. And this librarian, sorry, I'm getting emotional. I just remember, I have this vivid memory of this one time, she kind of said, hey, and she called out to me, and I went over to her desk, which was the one right by the exit. And she reached down and she gave me this big jar of nuts. It was like a big can of mixed nuts.
Oh, and the librarian gives Celia some nuts in the Butterfly Girl.
Yeah, and she gave me, and I can't tell you how much that meant to me. It's like this person gave me food, you know, this very nurturing, loving gift of somebody that saw me. And I suddenly felt like I wasn't invisible anymore. I wasn't just some sort of trash to be kicked around the curb. I felt like this person saw me, and I felt like she cared about me. It just meant the world to me.
Now, Naomi and Celia and other characters in the book, in your previous novels, you write about severely traumatized people, and you were traumatized by your childhood. Yet, despite your difficult childhood, marked by abuse, neglect, poverty, and homelessness, you managed to heal. Despite this trauma, there are those, however, who never heal. They end up probably depressed, angry, sometimes even suicidal. What do you think makes the difference between someone who recovers and someone who doesn't? Is it that power of the imagination? Are there other things involved?
You know, I think everybody has the potential to heal. I don't believe that people get broken permanently or damaged permanently. I think sometimes we want to believe that because then we don't feel a responsibility to each other. But we do. We all have a responsibility to each other. And we all have the capacity to heal. And actually, honestly, I think we all have the responsibility to help each other heal. And there's so many ways to do that. You know, there's you know, therapeutic programs. There's so many ways that we could do more to help people. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't think there's necessarily anything special about me. I feel like I got really lucky because I happened into doing things that were very healing for me.
Including writing. And then you had good friends in the punk scene and mm-hmm. this librarian and Catherine yeah. Dunn.
Yeah, I was lucky in the sense that I had people that came into my life that demonstrated care for me. And, you know, I think sometimes we get caught up in feeling that, you know, there's nothing we can do. But, you know, everybody has the power to make that kind of difference in somebody else's life. And sometimes it's those very simple acts of befriending somebody, of, you know, the way that Catherine Dunn befriended me, or the my boxing coach Jesse did, or that librarian. Those things, I think, have the powerful importance of those are the, you know, it's through those kind of human connections that I think a lot of healing takes place.
And it must feel very good for the person who's doing the helping too. I think it's a mutual relationship.
Yeah, exactly. And also I think one thing that has been really helpful for me is being a parent, because by parenting my children, I kind of reparented myself. I got to have the childhood that I often longed for by being a parent.
You kind of knew how not to do it. Yeah, yes. You went the opposite way.
Yeah, and none of us are perfect at it, of course. But pursuing ways to help other, I think when we help other people too, that's a way that we can help ourselves.
Now, this is a little sensitive, but I did ask you mm-hmm. if I could ask this question mm-hmm. before we started. In last Sunday's Oregonian, which is our daily paper mm-hmm. here in Portland, there was an article on the alarming increase in child suicide in the state. And I saw this passage in The Butterfly Girl. You write, "Lost. You can be lost even when you've been found. You can make the wrong turn in life, even if you're surrounded by people who love you." That was what suicide was, Naomi figured. It was choosing the final exit instead of another path, not because you wanted to hurt anyone, but because you feel too hopeless to find your way home. And this is the sensitive part. You lost mm-hmm. your older brother to suicide a few years ago. I've lost two friends to mm-hmm. suicide. It just tears you up inside, and you don't really know the reasons why. I was wondering, was Naomi channeling your thoughts in this passage?
Thank you for asking. Yeah, I lost my older brother to suicide. Actually, wasn't the only time in my family. And at the time that happened, you know, I'm thankful now that we're talking about this more, because I think there's so much stigma and silence around suicide. But it's sadly surprisingly common, and it's increasing. And there's, you know, so much we can do. But yeah, suicide, I lost my brother, and, you know, suicide is a grief unlike anything else. I think it's a grief that brings with it so much guilt.
Yes, how come I didn't know? Yeah. What could I have done?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, here's your brother. I felt that with these two friends. I saw no indication of it.
Yeah, yeah. And with my brother, I knew he was depressed and sad. And so I carry a lot of remorse. I go over the things that I wish I would have done, the things I could have done, and trying to accept those feelings in myself, that it's okay to carry the remorse. It's okay to carry the guilt. But there's so much to do. I think this month actually is Suicide Prevention Month.
That might have been why they ran the article.
Yeah, and I think there's so much we can do in that way. A lot of suicides go back to the issue we were just talking about. A lot of times they're related to trauma people have experienced. And we leave people alone in their trauma in this country. And that's another way in which we can help each other, you know, by being there. And I'm glad you brought it up, because I think we need to start talking about these things openly so that people that are feeling suicidal can reach out to other people.
And know that other people care, and we don't want you to go away and die.
No,
we're here for you.
Yeah, there's a different path through the woods.
Now, what motivates you in your writing and your work as an investigator? I'm guessing from reading the book that it has something to do with a passage in The Butterfly Girl, and this kind of goes in with our recent subject of suicide. Mm. You go into something called the Parable of the Starfish, which a police officer who's working with Naomi on the case thinks that that's Naomi's motivation. Mm-hmm. And Renee, I wondered if you would read that for us.
I'd be happy to.
It's a short passage from the book.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Naomi reminded Winfield of the parable of the starfish. A man, out on the beach one day, stopped to find a boy throwing starfish back into the sea. There were hundreds of starfish washed up on the beach, and the man explained to the boy that he couldn't save them all. "I can save one," the boy replied.
So, even if you could save one, it's certainly worth the effort.
Well, yeah, saving one is better than saving none, right?
Right. And that's, would you agree that that's part of your motivation? Not just as a writer, but as an investigator, the death row and working with abused children and captured children?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, I'm driven by a strong urge to, I think, take the things that happened to me and to turn them into something useful to help other people. But I also think we live in this society that tells us that we're helpless, that teaches us to not act because we feel that there's nothing we can do. And I know from my life that nothing could be further from the truth. And so interestingly, like the longer that I do the death row work, the longer I've been a foster adoptive parent, the more hopeful I become. Because I feel like I'm kind of engaged in the process of making change. And that's actually a profoundly optimistic thing to be doing.
And here's another thing that you did very recently that I think is very important and makes change. You taught a workshop, I think a few days ago, at Corporeal Writing here in Portland called Writing from the Margins. You say it's for fellow ex-homeless people, single moms, the previously incarcerated, those without degrees, women, people of color, and anyone struggling with how to find their voice. Could you tell us a little bit about that class and how that workshop went?
I think it was
last Sunday, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was just a couple of days ago. It was amazing. And that Corporeal is just a fantastic writing center.
Lydia Yuknovich.
Yeah, she's just running this amazing writing center downtown. I highly recommend if people are interested in becoming a writer or honing their craft and skills to sign up for classes there. They teach classes in craft and voice and all sorts of things. And it's really about breaking down the barriers. So I did this workshop and it was just astonishing. There were people in the workshop that were previously and are currently homeless. There were people that had been trafficked, people that have just experienced horrifying trauma. And we all kind of came together and it was, you know, incredibly supportive. And my main focus of doing the workshop was to really try to let people know that our voices matter too. And I think right now, particularly with everything this country is facing, we need the voices of people that have been through the worst kind of hell and come out the other side. You know, we need the people that have walked on the side of sorrow and seen the dawn. You know, these are the people that we need to lead us out of this dark place.
Oh, that's beautiful. Do you keep in touch with your students then? Have they started writing and have you read some of their stories?
Of course,
it's just been 2 days.
But well, actually, I ended the workshop by giving out my private email. I love mentoring other writers. I feel like I was blessed to have people like Catherine Dunn lift me up and to support me. So now I try my best to lift up other people and to support other aspiring writers.
And for these people to see you in your position coming from your background, it must be incredibly inspiring to them.
Yeah, I think, and you know, that's something we need to show, because particularly right now in the writing world, there's such a focus on people having MFAs or having these sort of higher degrees. And if you can afford to do that, and if you want to do that, by all means, do it. But I'm kind of here to say that, you know, we need to make sure that we have a genuine diversity of voices. And that has to include people that don't have access to
MFA programs.
MFA programs, which is most of us.
Right. They can get pretty expensive. You can go into about $100,000 of debt going through one of those.
You can. And that's something I would urge caution about, going into debt for a degree that, you know, won't equate into income.
Yes. Unfortunately, there's other fields like that, too. Now, you've said that with The Butterfly Girl, you returned to the character Naomi after you wrote The Child Finder because you needed to complete her story, which involves searching for her lost sister. Are you planning another Child Finder novel with Naomi? Maybe next in a series?
You know, I haven't decided yet, to be honest.
The publisher's probably begging for it.
You know, I was thinking about this the other day. You have people like Sue Grafton, who started an Alphabet series.
Remember that? And she's stuck. She has to go to Z,
yeah,
right?
That's exactly what I thought. I thought, oh my gosh, can you imagine if you start an Alphabet series like A is for this, B is... And then probably by the time she got to letter G, she was just tearing her hair out.
Yeah, or Arthur Conan Doyle. He killed off Sherlock Holmes, but his public wouldn't let him. He had to bring him back to life. You know?
I don't want to find myself in that position.
Where you're just writing about Naomi.
Yeah, for me, I have to feel genuinely called into the story. Mm. I have to feel that there's a reason to tell the story. And the reason has to really go to my bones. It has to be something I feel really deep in my heart that's important. And, you know, The Butterfly Girl is about homelessness and abuse and trauma and survival, and they're important things. So if another Naomi story comes to me, it's going to have those. It's going to have to feel just as important.
And maybe one of those voices speaking to you, like with the other three books, with your three previous novels.
Maybe it'll happen when I'm driving home.
I bet it will.
I hope so.
I don't know about today, but I think it eventually will.
Yeah, I don't want to have to wait for another snowstorm.
Well, I'm looking forward to whatever you write next. It's just not just beautiful writing, but the feeling behind it and the compassion it evokes and the stories it tells of people that we tend to ignore every day, but it builds empathy. We get to see the world through their eyes and maybe feel a little bit better about ourselves, you know, that we're maybe a little more privileged than we think, as bad as things might get. And there's ways out of it because these characters certainly find those ways, and you found that path yourself.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much, Renee.
Thank you for having me on.
We've been talking with Renee Denfeld, author of the new novel, The Butterfly Girl, from HarperCollins. Renee will be reading and signing books at Powell City of Books in downtown Portland on Tuesday, October 1st at 7:30 p.m., and she'll be appearing at the Portland Book Festival on Saturday, November 9th. You can learn more about Renee's upcoming events and her work at reneedenfeld.com. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KABU Community Radio. Many thanks to Renee for visiting us at KABU and to all of you for listening.